This week on Lunchbox Envy. Pope Alexander VI was notorious for allegedly poisoning political rivals at banquets.
Rasputin famously survived cyanide-laced cakes and wine.
And around 100 Americans a year die from choking on pen lids.
Oh, what a way to go. It's Deadly Dishes. Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Jack and I'm here with my fellow QI elves, Manu and Alex.
Hello.
Hello.
Quite a morbid start, but I imagine quite a morbid continuation.
Mm-hmm. What do we mean by deadly dishes though? What are we actually looking at?
I've mostly looked at various things that are poisonous if you have too much of them. Mm-hmm. Which I think basically everything.
Well, I was going to say, I found the origin of your favourite quote.
Oh yeah.
That everything is poisonous if you eat enough of it. Exactly, yeah. if you eat enough of it. So it's from a 16th century Swiss doctor. It's from a 17th century Swiss doctor.
Cool. We should get a pickup of you just saying every century.
We never get it right. To be fair, it is so annoying, but like the 1700s is the 18th century. Like that's just dumb. Yeah. Anyway,
so I'm trying to, basically this Swiss doctor who's living in the 16th century called Paracelsus, born Theophrastus Bombast of Hohenheim.
Great name. Wow. 10 out of 10 for name.
Such a good name.
Why on earth did he change it to Paracelsus?
Well, he wanted to give Galen and Celsus a kind of run for their money.
And Galen and Celsus were
kind of like old Greek.
Classical.
Yeah, classical physicians who kind of popularized the theory that the body kind of ran on four humours, kind of different elements. Yeah. Like heat and dryness and bile and phlegm. And
there was like black bile, yellow
black bile,
and yellow bile.
And then blood and phlegm. I think
a lot of different fluids.
Yeah, there were four main fluids, and they were all just linked to like hot foods would make your blood hotter, and they had to all be in balance, which is why bloodletting was a thing. They would sort of diagnose people with too much blood,
and they explained different personality types by whether if you were like a real like black bile bitch, then like that meant that you were hot headed.
But there's also a thing about not living by swamps because that made you
of the bad air.
I don't know.
Oh, is that explains Shrek? That's why he's so grumpy. Yeah. So anyway, yes. That's all bullshit. I think we can agree that like humans were believed for hundreds of years, but not correct
that's
medically.
True. So Paracelsus, he chose this name because it kind of like directly challenged these physicians.
Oh, and Paracelsus. I get it. Like against Celsus.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also he kind of wanted the oomph that comes with having one name, kind of like Dido or Beyonce or that kind of hard.
I was going to say Stendhal, but
So he was one of the first people in medicine to be like, we should be running experiments and trying things for ourselves in the kind of formulaic way. And he is also known as the father of toxicology.
I read that he was, quote, controversial, combative, and openly critical of universities.
Sounds pretty toxic.
Paracelsus. Yeah, talk about a toxic workplace.
Toxic masculinity.
He is a person that said, all things are poison and nothing is without poison. Solely the dose determines that a thing is not a poison.
It's quite emo. All things are poison.
So technically today we could talk about any food. Because if you eat enough of it, you will die.
Or even no food. If you eat enough no food,
that is true. Yeah.
But is it not the case, actually, that there's a lot of foods that your body would reject? You would be sick before you were able to eat enough to kill you by toxicity.
Or your kidneys would process it. I remember reading about, I think we mentioned in the coffee episode, 42 espressos is enough to kill you.
Yeah. No.
But you can't physically process that much caffeine in one go. Your kidneys filter it out, so you wee it all out before you can get to the 42nd.
Okay.
Yeah.
We've also been using, like, intentionally exploiting poisons for a really, really long time. So this year, archaeologists found poison arrowheads at a kind of archaeological site in South Africa, and they've been dipped in the juices of a plant called gifbol, or poisonous onion.
Please the name.
Yep. And that plant is still used by hunters in the area today. So they're still dipping weapons in it and using it to kill animals more quickly. Wow. So it's been for 60,000 years. That's how old the arrowhead is. which is really cool.
Somewhere I would really like to visit. Mm-hmm. And if we had any budget on this podcast, mm-hmm. we would probably be coming to you live from this place.
Wow.
Is the Poison Garden
in
Alnwick Castle mm-hmm. In Northumberland, mm-hmm. which you think it sounds like a very sort of gothic 100 years old. Mm-hmm. It was actually built in 2005.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
By, I knew it was like adored.
I know. This is the thing. So, yes, the Jane Percy, who is the Duchess of Northumberland, created it. And she was basically very interested in the idea of a medicinal garden. Mm. And actually, that a lot of these plants that we might eat or use as medicines mm-hmm. can be toxic in the wrong dose.
Right.
So it's a locked garden with walls and a gate with a skull and crossbones on the front. Oh. You can only enter on guided tours. There are over 100 toxic species of plants inside, including deadly nightshades, nice. Hemlock, mm-hmm. Castor bean plants.
Oh, yeah.
But that produces ricin. Foxglove.
Yeah,
which
Digitalis,
which is actually like a heart medication drug, but it can stop your heart, right?
Yeah, I think if you have it in small doses, it's doctors use very small doses to boost your heart rate.
Yeah, they've got a strychnine tree,
ooh.
A cannabis plant.
Is cannabis poisonous?
It's a toxin, I guess. I think not all these plants will literally kill you if you take them. It depends on the dose. But some of them are hazardous, even if you touch them or go near them. Some of them release fumes, especially on hot days. You might go and feel faint, but everyone is warned not to smell, touch or taste anything.
Wow, mm-hmm. Hold your breath.
Yeah.
I'm picturing the guided tours all being done by Professor Sprout.
Yeah.
Miriam Margulies.
Yes, I wonder if they've got that devil's snare, that plant that grabs people.
Whomping willows.
Yeah. That's not really poisonous. It's deadly.
It's deadly. Oh, actually, Alnwick Castle is where they filmed the outside shots of Harry Potter.
That's true.
Maybe
oh my
that
gosh.
Was a subconscious thing. In
yeah,
my head.
I thought it's brilliant.
Very
yeah,
clever.
Cool. Just a little bit on words.
Yes.
In German, the word for poison is Gift. Das Gift.
Ooh.
A gift. It comes from the same root as the English word gift, as in a present.
Okay.
Because the idea is that it's something given.
Administered. Oh, like a vaccine is given.
It's similar in Danish and Swedish. The word for married and poison.
No way.
Kind of very similar. Because again, you used to give someone a marriage.
Oh, you'd give away your daughter or something.
And of course, woman, a poison.
Thanks. So, shall we go through some classic food poisoning?
Go for it. Yeah.
Right. So, if you guys are out on a really, really hot day and you're making margaritas.
Are we talking cocktails or pizzas?
Cocktails. There is a chance your margarita might seriously burn you.
Oh,
like damage your skin.
Okay, how?
Furocoumarins are toxins that plants release when they're really stressed out. So citrus, celery, carrots, figs, wild parsley and wild dill all release this toxin. And it can give you something called margarita burn or phytophotodermatitis. So if you're using loads of limes, you're in the sun, you get this chemical on your skin, it can make you really, really sensitive to sunlight, so particularly UVA rays, and it makes your skin blister. So you've seen people after making margaritas and their hands are just like bubbles. And then there's something called cyanogenic glycosides.
Uh-huh. My favourite.
They're found in at least 2,000 different plant species.
Mm.
And when we digest them, they release cyanide. So they're in a lot of stone fruits. They're in almonds.
Oh,
okay.
And cyanide poisoning from these plants can leave us with breathing trouble, blood pressure issues, dizziness, headaches, and then it gets worse and worse until we start twitching and have a fit and end up in a terminal coma.
Wow.
So don't eat too many of those foods.
Well, and cyanide, I feel like, is most famously in apple cores.
Exactly, yes. And you'd need to eat so many apple pips and you need to like really, really chew them. So in order to get at these cyanogenic glycosides, you'd need to like really, really thoroughly grind them. And then you'd need to eat hundreds. And obviously it depends on your weight.
Oh, yes.
The lethal dose of cyanide in the apple pips, but it's really, really, really low.
Okay. You
can eat basically an entire apple. You don't like an apple core is more of a social construct than
wow.
It's true. It's like
someone's been smoking something from the poison garden. Yeah. Apple cores are just a social construct, man. Yeah.
Okay, it's time for our first lunchbox, and this week that's coming from Alex.
I have brought
a piece of paper.
A license to prepare food.
Oh.
A license to make fugu. It's what a license to not kill, actually, is what it is. Weirdly. Not a real license. I printed it out off the internet.
I was gonna say, not valid. That's not your face.
An definitely. Asian man on it. Yeah. Fugu is, I think, probably the poster boy of kind of dangerous, poisonous, famous foods.
Uh-huh. Right? So.
It's the Japanese name for a certain species of pufferfish.
Mm-hmm.
Ah. Most famously, Takifugu rubripes. And it's probably one of the only foods where a small mistake in how you prepare it will almost certainly be fatal to you. Specific parts of the pufferfish are absolutely fine to eat, really the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much all the other parts contain very high doses of a very powerful neurotoxin called tetrodotoxin.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the danger comes from.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a few animals, but pufferfish is really the main one that we would try to eat. The way it works, it's kind of a terrifying toxin. It basically affects your nerve cells and it stops your nerves from sending electrical signals.
Yeah, great. It sounds like a stress relief.
Maybe for the first 5 seconds. Yeah.
Isn't that what death is, ultimately?
Yeah. I'm not nervous.
You said it like that, yeah. But it basically means that your muscles can't contract. So you'll go numb, you'll stop being able to move, and eventually all of your muscles will stop working, which means that, you know, your breathing muscles will stop working, your respiratory system will stop.
Damn.
But it doesn't affect your brain, so you will probably be conscious for all of this. Inside the fish, the tetrodotoxin is concentrated mainly in the liver and the ovaries and sometimes the skin, and it's the muscle flesh specifically that is safe. Mm. Also, cooking does nothing to destroy it as well, so you can't get around it. Yeah,
it's quite heat resistant, isn't it?
Yeah. In the Yamaguchi prefecture of Shimonoseki, is widely known as Japan's fugu capital because it sits on the Kamon Strait. There's an abundant supply of pufferfish from the sea. It's a winter dish. It's served as sashimi, so it's sliced really thin, almost so thin that it's almost transparent when you look through it, and arranged in a chrysanthemum pattern.
Ooh.
And chrysanthemums are a funeral flower.
Oh yes.
So
that is a bit of a sick joke.
Exactly. I know, right? Today it is a very highly controlled food. So in Japan, chefs can't legally serve fugu unless they hold a special government license, which was the thing that I brought.
I see.
Yeah. Training will take 2 to 3 years.
Wow.
You have to train under really experienced chefs.
Sorry, you're doing other things whilst you're training.
Probably.
Right?
I think it's full time. Yeah. Pretty comprehensive. So you have to identify the safe species because there are lots of different species.
Oh.
You have to understand.
Wait, the safe species? This is the safe one.
Yeah, yeah. The toxin in the fish varies by region and season. And the tetrodotoxin is not produced by the fish itself. It comes from this marine bacteria that has a symbiotic relationship with the fish.
That's so cool.
And it accumulates it. The pufferfish accumulates it through its life, through the food chain. Mm-hmm. So actually, it can vary depending on the season.
The age of the fish.
And the age of the fish, the season, time of the season, where you catch the fish from. And actually, you can also farm fugu in a clean environment and they can be mostly non-toxic. So there is a sort of safer version that you can get.
Fugu.
Yeah, exactly.
No stupid questions. Mm. Why do they puff up again?
It's a defense mechanism, isn't it?
Yeah. So is it more spiky?
Spiky and big.
If some predators swallow them and then they puff up.
That's so mean. Clever. Okay, got it.
And that's why we don't eat them alive.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But yeah, actually, when you think about it, they've got a hell of an array of defense mechanisms as a species. They're dangerous alive, they're dangerous dead. Good on them. Yeah, so on this exam, they identify different species. They have to practice removing all the dangerous organs, of course.
Mm.
And then at the end, they have to pass a 3-part exam. The written exam and their practical preparation, and the pass rate is apparently around 30 to 40%. So, I mean, it's really hard.
It's pretty stringent, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. The final test, famously, the chef has to prepare the fish and then the examiner checks it and then the chef has to eat their own dish.
Well,
yeah.
You would. Sorry.
It makes sense. Yeah, it does. Yeah.
You don't make other people eat your fugu if you will not eat your fugu.
That's
is
true.
The famous Japanese saying. But I am so pleased that it is such a stringent test.
Because they don't do that on MasterChef. You never see them eating their own food, which I always think is really sus. Anyway, so that is what fugu is and how it's served and the hoops you have to jump through to be able to serve it. My two questions are, why are we eating this food and how have we got to the point where we can safely eat this food? So my first question, is it the most delicious food ever?
Well,
surely.
I imagine it would.
Apparently, obviously I haven't tried it. Mm-hmm. I wasn't able to get any today. It's not legal in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I think actually if it is ever served in most, Western countries, you need a really special set of licenses and permissions and all sorts. Mm. I read that the flavour is... it's got quite a nice, subtle, clean flavour. It's quite a light fish meat, and it's got a very nice, I think, firm, springy, refined texture. Yeah. So it's a nice meat, but I don't think it's like, it's not like the giant turtle meat where people cannot stop eating it because it's so delicious. I don't think it's sought after. How on earth did we get to this point where we know how to prepare this incredibly complicated and difficult dish? And the answer is basically trial and error. Yeah, exactly. The history of fugu goes back a really long way. People have been eating pufferfish in Japan for thousands of years. They found bones in old rubbish piles from 3000 BCE.
Ooh.
So what century is that, Manu? I'm not sure.
Oh, don't even.
It's around the time of pyramids.
Yes.
Throughout history, we know that there have been several periods where it's been banned or restricted. So we know that like a lot of people were trying to eat it and it was harming and killing a lot of people. Mm. So for example, during the Imjin War from 1592 to 1598, apparently several samurai died after eating it. So the warlord that controlled them banned them from eating it. Mm. In the Edo period, kind of Shogun era, there were lots of bans and people used to eat fugu secretly. Because back in history, food is a lot more about survival. I don't think they had to eat it, but it was abundant. Mm-hmm. And there were kind of simple rules they realized. They were like, don't eat the organs. And so you could eat the meat and sometimes get away with it. But even so, it would have been a lot of trial and error and become this art form, because the way that you have to carve out every single bit of meat is really precise.
Yeah. And it's not like the poisonous bits are luminous green either. Like,
no, this is the thing. There's no way of telling exactly. It was really kind of post-World War II that these formalized legal system came into place.
Would you guys try it?
Absolutely not. What would you?
Well, no, I don't think so.
Really?
I
mean,
kind of why I picked it as a lunchbox was because it's, I mean, since I was a kid, I've heard of fugu, and it's been this legendary thing. Mm. And actually, the reason why there's an industry today where you can buy it and it's known as a delicacy, it's not because it's so delicious. I think it's a nice to eat, but actually so much of it is this prestige. It's the prestige of being a fugu chef who can make it, so that keeps that side of the industry alive. And then there's the prestige of being basically like macho and cool enough and brave enough to eat a food that has a risk associated with it, which just fascinates me as part of the human condition.
It's a fascinating cultural artifact. Yeah. Does anyone eat fugu and not tell anyone? Because the whole point is you film yourself
if
on TikTok
for the ground,
eating fugu.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's like not going for a run if your Strava app's not working.
Yeah.
What's the point if no one can see?
I think you could die eating so many kinds of foods. I think the odds of you dying eating this fish, if you do it properly with a licensed person who's gone through so many checks, versus say going to someone's house who doesn't have hygiene training that's made you a dish and probably won't die, but like
homemade fugu for sure. But I also think it's coming, we're at the end of the chain of this idea that like how many deaths did it take to get to this point
that's a good point.
And it got me thinking as well about other prestige foods, other like what I think of as quite dumb foods. Salt bay food with gold leaf in, these are all things which are not necessarily better or tastier or really an experience that is sensorially superior, but you're buying into some kind of something culturally.
But as we have learned through all of our discussions about what makes something taste good and kind of the mental side of eating, like if you are paying more for the thing, if you're paying for the story and the experience and the novelty and the danger, it is probably going to make it taste better.
Do you
to
think that
you.
The adrenaline rush you get from eating fugu, like actually you really concentrate on
probably,
it?
Probably, yeah. Because it's not often you're eating a fish that's arranged in a flower of death by a chef who's like spent 3 years learning how to cut this little bit of meat. Like kind
you'd
of
never
ritual.
Concentrate so much on what's in your mouth.
Yeah.
Because you'd be like, is it making my mouth tingle?
It could be the last thing you eat, so you're gonna taste it.
Yeah, it is last meal vibes. Yeah.
That must be such a flex
that's,
to order.
Such
your
a
last
good last meal.
Meal.
but like, I'll have fugu from like the most junior trainee chef.
Yeah, I don't think many people have it twice, not just because they die, but because like the thrill is not quite the same the second time.
Yeah, once you've done it, you've done it. It also reminded me, I think we did it on QI a long time ago, but the heart attack grill in America is kind of the Western equivalent, maybe.
Wait,
in a way.
What is it?
So it's in Las Vegas. It opened in 2005 and it's basically got this slightly sick joke kind of theming.
It's a hospital theme, basically.
It's a hospital theme, yeah. All the waiters actually waitresses mm-hmm. are sort of dressed in quite skimpy nurse outfits.
But the idea is that all the food is so unhealthy that you basically are already in hospital because this is going to kill you or give you a heart attack.
I think you weigh yourself at the start, and then if you're over something like 300 pounds, you get your meal for free or something.
What? Yeah, the thing is, it's weird because it's kind of ironic, but then it's not ironic because somebody actually did have a massive heart attack in there.
Obviously, the food they serve is basically you have like the triple bypass burger, which is like 8,000 calories, and you can like add patties until it's bigger than your
the octuple bypass is 20,000 calories.
Wait, what's the recommended daily intake again?
2,000. So that's 10 times the daily.
And then if you don't finish your meal, you have to lean over and get spanked by one of the waitresses. So it's kind of like
kinky as well.
That sounds
kinky,
fun, but the eating that many burger patties.
And the only thing they serve that is vegan is cigarettes. that's a similar sort of cultural vibe, I suppose. It's quite macho. I mean, even just those YouTubers who just eat enormous plates. Competitive eating, basically.
All competitive eating has that element to it, because you're being macho basically by saying like, how much can I eat, but none of it's healthy, and you like, some of it could be deadly.
There are about a dozen competitive eaters who've died in the last 10 years.
Really?
Yeah, mostly through choking, because obviously you're stuffing quite a lot of food into two very close tubes. There was a man in Florida in 2012 who died in a cockroach eating contest.
Oh.
He choked on some bits of carapace.
No.
And in a very Florida way, he was competing to win a python.
A live python. Oh, my God. That is so Florida.
What is America? Yeah. Sorry.
Emperor Claudius' son died from chucking a pear in the air and catching it.
A pear is huge.
Yeah. Yeah, true.
Did it just completely like completely block off the mouth?
I mean, we don't know. It's time for our second lunchbox, and this week that is mayonnaise. What have you brought?
I have brought cassava.
Ooh.
I know.
I always imagine what I thought snozcumbers looked like from the BFG. So they kind of look like cucumbers, but they're more knobbly and weirdly shaped, and they're brown and kind have quite a rough textured skin to them. They've almost got bark on the outside, actually. Mm-hmm. They're very planty.
They do.
And they've got not knobbly ends.
They're very knobbly, kind of woody.
Yeah.
So this is a staple food for loads of people around the world.
Okay, yeah.
Good, starchy, sugary carbohydrate.
Nice.
But if you don't prepare it properly, it can kill you.
So is it kind of potato-esque inside?
Yeah, it's kind of like yummy. You can, break it.
Yeah, so I break it open.
Ooh, hey, nice.
Oh, wow. It's almost like polystyrene. It looks, it's white and it's actually quite solid. It's like probably coconut. Yeah.
It is a tuber and it's cultivated throughout the world, lots of hot countries. It's used in flours and breads, makes tapioca. It's also sometimes used as a laundry starch.
Oh,
really, really versatile food. It's used to make booze. But like I said, it can make you really sick. And there's a really interesting story that kind of tells us about intergenerational knowledge when it comes to preparing and kind of detoxifying foods, very similar to the fugu. There's a really brilliant article by a journalist called Tim Harford. In the 1980s, there was a Swedish doctor called Hans Rosling who's working in Mozambique.
Yes, I know the guy. Well, I mean, I've watched his videos. I don't know. He died a few years ago.
Damn. And he had a lot of patients, a lot of children coming to him with a condition called Konzo, which is a sudden paralysis of the legs.
Oh.
And Rosling could not figure out what this was because it didn't have any of the kind of textbook symptoms of polio, which he thought it was, because that affects your legs as well.
Yeah.
And with the help of an epidemiologist called Julie Cliff, they figured out that it was actually a combination of poor nutrition, so malnutrition in poor communities, and cyanide poisoning from cassava.
Gosh.
Because that is the thing that makes it so toxic. Basically, a lot of these poor families were so hungry, they were rushing through the preparation of cassava and eating it too soon, and it hadn't had time to detoxify.
So the long history of growing and then cooking cassava.
Yes, but not in Mozambique.
Oh.
So cassava is indigenous to Central America, and we think it comes from the Yucatan. And in those countries, they've got a really, really, really long history of cultural.
Like a culture of it, so they know what they're doing.
So there's loads and loads of different steps. This includes scraping it, grating it, washing it, boiling it, leaving it to stand for days, and then baking it. And obviously, if you're really hungry, this takes a long time.
You want to skip the stages, yeah.
Exactly. And cassava was only brought over to Africa by Portuguese colonists in the 16th century.
Okay.
1700s.
You went the wrong way. You went the wrong way again.
No way.
16th
century, 1500s. I was so proud of myself. Okay. So they don't have that same kind of long cultural intergenerational knowledge of how to prepare this food. And then Tim Harford in this article kind of really hones in on the kind of science and psychology behind intergenerational learning. Yeah, yeah. A lot of psychologists think that humans aren't actually that clever. We're not like our raw intelligence isn't that good. What we're really, really good at is copying each other.
Right.
Studies have shown that humans and baby chimpanzees, so about 2.5 years old, they have the same kind of raw mental capacity.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. But human babies are way better at copying the adults they're around.
Interesting.
To the point where often you'll copy mistakes just because everyone else is making them. It's called over-imitation. And it means that we have been able to copy processes between generations and over a really long time without understanding why we're doing it. We're just like, everyone's doing this thing with this vegetable.
It's evolution. They're unconsciously like just attacking a problem with brute force.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
And it works. And it means that we have all of these incredible processes, like how to prepare cassava, how to prepare fugu. Mm. But also we end up with weird stuff like rain dances and weird folk medicine and all of these different beliefs that are still this process of copying, but have wildly different
results. It's gone down a route that just hasn't been, it's not actively dangerous to do a rain dance. Yeah, it doesn't kill off all the people who do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But today, luckily, not that many people are dying of konzo because of Rosling's amazing work. And in countries like Ghana, people are actually using cassava to create electricity and biofuels and all of these incredible like green energy. So it's a great food. It could kill you, but it's also really, really useful, and it feeds thousands and thousands of people around the world. And there's our happy poisonous food.
But also many of our listeners will be aware of him, but do check out Hans Rosling's TED Talks, especially because he was a great science communicator and he has a great one about why the world population won't go above 11 billion.
Good, because the tube is already busy enough.
So another food that contains cyanogenic glycosides, so the thing that produces cyanide.
On the topic of cyanogenic glycosides.
Is the wild yam. Mm. And there's a Mexican wild yam, which famously became the pill.
I've heard about this. The contraceptive,
Pill. So back in the day, it was really, really hard to synthesize hormones. A lot of the hormones we got were from dead animals. Took loads of time, was really, really expensive.
I still struggle personally.
It's a hard life.
It's not easy.
And then in 1942, there was a chemist called Russell Marker who realized that he could convert a chemical in Mexican wild yams to create progesterone, which is one of the active ingredients in the pill, which will mess with how your uterus lining forms. Today, it's estimated that like 100 million women use the pill, and it's actually probably saved countless lives by preventing dangerous legal abortions. And it is just like another fantastic use for a very poisonous food.
Great. I've never had a contraceptive pill. Do they taste of yam slightly?
I'm going to say no.
Just on the topic of background knowledge, did you see the AI recipe generator in 2023?
No.
There's a New Zealand supermarket called Pack and Save, and they created an AI recipe maker called Savey Mealbot. And
stupid name.
Well, turns out quite stupid AI, because they recommended things including bleach fresh breath mocktail, a mocktail made of bleach, ant poison and glue sandwiches, bleach infused rice surprise,
and the surprise being death,
maybe, and methanol bliss, a kind of turpentine flavored French toast. But one of the things it did recommend was chlorine gas, which is illegal to produce under the Geneva Protocol. And you can make chlorine gas with, well, maybe I shouldn't advertise this, but if you mix bleach.
Reggie's not here. Jack, have you got any fun recipes for us this week?
Yes, actually. Basically, don't ever mix bleach with some sort of acid like vinegar because it can make chlorine gas. And if
this is a really common thing that that you might accidentally do with cleaning materials at home. Yeah. So they're two common things you have. Yeah.
So I think that was what the bot was getting confused. If you added bleach and vinegar to your basket, it would make.
It was an unintended consequence of this separately poisonous dish.
Okay, it's time for our final lunchbox, and this week it's mine. So first we've got some liver.
Okay, lovely.
And then slightly more appealing, I think, we've got some marzipan chocolate.
Yes, yum.
And then I've brought you some wheat in the form of a shortbread biscuit, some corned beef.
Okay.
And hot steaming beverage.
I'm not using a coaster, don't worry about it. It's only my darkwood table.
So these represent different historical poisonings, and I want to go through them one by one.
Oh, fun. Okay.
Nice.
And enough time has passed that there's no sort of too soon elements to it. But, which one do you want to start
biscuits,
with?
Biscuits, please. I would love a biscuit.
Biscuits. Okay.
All right.
So how is this going to kill us?
Think back to 6th century BCE. There's a kingdom in China called Jin. J-I-N, not G-I-N.
What?
The Duke Jing of Jin, confusingly named. He was reigning between 599 and 581 BCE. Mm. He was told by a shaman that he wouldn't live to see the next wheat harvest. So he had the shaman killed.
That is a great solution to these bullshit predictions.
And then he sort of ordered some wheat in when the new harvest was there. As soon as he ate it, he felt the need to go to the bathroom. And then he fell through the privy and drowned in the sewage. So,
nice.
Karma for killing the shaman, I think.
Love that.
Next one?
I'll give the hot drink, please.
Ooh.
Okay, so this is Nero's stepbrother. It was called Britannicus. It was originally called Tiberius Claudius Germanicus because his father Claudius had conquered Germany. But then his father Claudius conquered Britain and they were like, oh, no, that's much better. We'll call you Britannicus. And Britannicus was heir to the throne. He was supposedly killed by Nero, who's a bit of a devious, villainous character in our modern retelling, when they were both teenagers with a clever little trick. So he poisoned his stepbrother. Firstly, the imperial court had a taster.
A taster to check, so to eat the food on
exactly,
behalf of the king.
Because poisoning the emperor was a legitimate concern.
Mm-hmm. Just historically speaking, how long would you have to wait for your dinner because some poisons
I think you're eating a lot of cold food. I think it is a really a genuine frustration with tasting.
The other thing that a taster provides is that they've got the palate to recognise poisons because poisons taste usually. Very few poisons have no taste. You would be able to detect. Anyway, so how do you get around the taster? What they did is they served Britannicus a hot drink, which the taster tried. But because it's so hot, when he serves it to Britannicus, he's like, too hot. So he pours in some cold water, which is just lying around, bypasses the taster, and that has the poison in.
That's really clever.
Genius.
And so Britannicus dies, apparently instantly. But we think Tacitus, who was a 1st century Roman historian, he was probably embellishing the story a little bit because he was alive 100 years after this happened. We don't think anyone could die instantly, and we don't think the poison could be odourless and colourless to be able to hide in a jug of water. But it was quite a clever trick.
But I suppose it's also like a hot drink. You probably get away with something tasting a bit off. You sip
we don't really know what the hot drink was. It might have been like cyanide flavoured.
Which would be tasty, right?
Marzipan. Which brings us to marzipan.
Yeah, let's do marzipan next because I want some.
So Pope Clement VII, 1478 to 1534, he was a very scientific pope. So one of the things he did was approve Copernicus's theory about the revolving planets. So Copernicus was the first to propose that actually the planets revolved around the sun and the Earth wasn't the main character anymore.
It's so funny you have to get a sign-off from the Vatican on that.
We did back then.
I know.
And this is 100 years before Galileo got in hot water about suggesting it.
Hipster.
So he was ahead of his time. Anyway, he also, in 1524, gave two criminals aconite-laced marzipan. Aconite is a famous poison. It's often known as wolfsbane.
That's what wolfsbane is.
And he gave the antidote to one of them, who then subsequently survived. And we think it was the first example of a experiment with a control.
Oh, that's
lovely.
So
he was
lovely.
Also ahead of his time.
Is that lovely money?
No, it's not.
It's not a story Christian thing to do, is it? To be the fucking Pope and to be like, I'm going to perform experiments on live humans.
He has the power to
do it. It's not the worst thing a Pope has done.
You don't say no to the Pope.
Yeah, that's true. Imagine getting to heaven and being like, the Pope killed me.
Like, it's like VIP.
How does that work? Yeah.
You fast track the
queue. Exactly.
But the Pope himself actually supposedly died of eating a death cap mushroom inadvertently.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, the 15th century seems to be a hotbed of poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
As all the Borgias, especially in Europe, everyone poisoning everyone.
There's that, but then also there's potentially the emergence of critical analysis of death, being like, why has this person died? I think it might be because they ate that thing and they turned blue, rather than, you know, it's an act of God.
Mm. Oh.
That's a good point. This is kind of the birth of science.
Yeah.
So that's that story. A little more on aconite. It's known as wolfsbane because they used to poison wolves with it back when you used to hunt wolves in Europe. Which is interesting because it comes from a plant genus from which many herbal recipes come. So, you know, the good and the bad. Make sure you get the right aconite. But mythologically, it was supposed to have come from Cerberus, you know, the three-headed dog.
The underworld. Yeah.
Cool.
His spittle. Because the symptoms of aconite poisoning are very similar to rabies.
Oh.
That's a good... I love that as an origin story.
Rabies symptoms include the, bubbling
the
and
mouth
going
and
really aggressive.
Most mammals can get it, and so it's most commonly passed on to humans by rabid dogs, because we live around dogs and they have quite fearsome bites, whereas a mouse won't give you rabies unless you're very unlucky. So that's aconite. Next one.
Yeah. Okay, let's do liver now.
The liver was used to kill Chu Tai of Egham.
Great name.
Who was a 2-year-old. Dog.
The roller coaster.
He was a show dog. He was a Pekingese.
Uh-huh.
And you can picture the tiny little kind of fluff on legs. Uh-huh. And he won 5 championships, including Crafts, which is basically the foremost dog show.
It's the
in
Oscars
world.
Of dog, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And 200 awards, like local awards.
Wow.
And so he was very famous.
Mm-hmm. And right being topped off.
1913. Yeah. So he was a target for terrorists.
Mm.
No, genuinely.
Terrorists.
Terrorists.
So he was unfortunately killed by some poisoned liver, we think. It was dropped into his pen.
Intentionally poisoned
with aconite.
By cats.
No. By suffragettes.
Oh, that's
because
great.
We got an anonymous note that said it was a necessary act until women got the vote.
Bitches.
That is quite rogue. Oh, that's a bad move for suffragettes. No one's going to support you for killing a dog. But I don't think that's a good vote. Ironically, a good vote winner for for your cause, I think. Was the dog anti-suffrage?
It was a male
dog. The dog didn't have the vote, though.
That's true. That brings us to corned beef killer. 1934, there's a woman called Ethel Major.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the only woman to be hanged at Hull Prison because Britain had the death penalty until the 60s. And so in 1934, if you killed your husband, as she did...
Allegedly.
You were liable to the death penalty. So,
I don't want
to
get sued by her ancestors.
So she had a bit of a strange upbringing. So she basically gave birth out of wedlock, which at the time was a huge controversy. She was 23, it was 1914. And to cover it up, her daughter was raised as her sister. By her parents, the daughter's grandparents.
Yeah.
Anyway, 4 years later, she marries a man who's come back from the Great War. They live in Lincolnshire. He drives a lorry. And 10 years into their marriage, he discovers the secret. And for some reason, he's a bit pissed off. And so he starts having affairs and being a bit abusive. So in today's eyes, I think Ethel's kind of, I mean, not justified, but there were reasons why
she was
the
in
marriage
an abusive relationship,
in trouble.
Yeah.
But so she was basically the daughter of a gamekeeper and she poisoned her husband's corned beef sandwiches with strychnine.
What?
And amazingly, he took the sandwiches to lunch, tried them, they tasted weird, and threw them away and said to his co-worker, my wife must be trying to poison me, which she actually was. and then a couple of days later, she made him some more corned beef sandwiches, and then he actually died of them. She would have got away with it, except she was quite hasty to have a funeral.
She'd already booked it.
Yeah, practically. And she was only discovered when an anonymous letter arrived at the coroner saying, sir, have you ever heard of a wife poisoning her husband? And we still don't know who sent the note, but it was signed...
Suffragettes, definitely.
It was signed Fair Play.
Ooh.
And they pointed out that a neighbour's dog had been killed by eating poisoned corned beef. Mm. And so we thought maybe it had come from...
The same place.
Ethel's failed experiment.
She was sloppy.
And she was also sloppy because when the police arrived, she said... Who would have heard of a husband being poisoned by strychnine? And the police hadn't mentioned strychnine.
Oh,
that's
and
they so also, amateur.
Yeah, no.
They also found a key to her dad's shed where he kept strychnine to poison, presumably wolves and
labels for poisoning husband. Yeah.
So she didn't get rid of that. So, and she had a motive because her husband was philandering. And so, she got locked up. And then the judge gave her the death penalty. So she was hanged. Actually, she was hanged by the Pierpoint family, who are kind of a dynasty of executioners.
Oh,
it's kind of a weird, surprisingly long history of execution. And then as soon as the death penalty was abolished, they had to go and do other things.
That's quite nice. I think if I had to be executed, I'd like to pick a
professional, famous one.
It's the John Lewis of executioners. We've been around a long time. On tasters. We mentioned tasters in an episode the other week. Throughout history, people in power who were potentially targets for poisoning would often employ tasters to try all their meals before them or all their food before them. And in the Second World War, I think you said, Manu, Adolf Hitler employed a group of food tasters who were all women.
A group of women.
I don't know whether they were intentionally all women or like whether that was just who was available.
It would be a weird coincidence. Like, there was all women.
Yeah. He's an equal opportunities employer.
Oh, my God.
I think well, there probably was a shortage of able-bodied men, weren't there?
Maybe because our taste perception is slightly more sensitive than...
Oh, interesting.
Did they know that at the time, though?
I don't know.
But yeah, they were based in the Wolf's Lair, which is now in Poland. There were about 15 of them. Yeah, I say employed. They were, I mean, not really doing this by choice. He was mostly a vegetarian, not completely. And so a lot of the food was like rice, pasta and vegetables. And the whole situation was absolutely terrifying. So the women spoke about it after the war. One of them was called Margot Volk. And she said, every meal was a torture. After every mouthful, we were afraid that we would die.
Of course,
so it was pretty bleak, yeah.
But did any of them die?
No, I don't think so.
It was quite a good way to avoid being poisoned in the first place. If you publicise that you have tasters, people might not want to kill an innocent party. Do you see
what
I mean?
Or just see like it's not going to work. So there's no point in trying. But yeah, apparently he was really worried about being poisoned. But all the assassination attempts were bomb-based.
Oh,
and then he shot himself in the head.
Yeah,
so,
he did it for us.
In the end, he was his own biggest enemy. Yeah. I don't know what the moral is.
In the end, he let himself down more than anything else,
Well, it sounds like a lot of Chinese emperors could have done with tasters because so many of them died trying to live forever.
Mm.
At least five in the Tang Dynasty alone, which is the 300 years between about 600 and 900 common era. At least five of those died by drinking mostly mercury-based immortality elixirs, because they just wanted to live forever. Part of the problem was when the emperor died from poisoning, so either the next one or the same one as he was dying would kill all of the people who'd come up with these poisons as punishment, which just meant that he had a whole new raft of like amateur poison makers.
Nothing to learn from.
He didn't learn from it. Of that intergenerational learning.
Absolutely.
So stupid. I had another fun group of tasters. Who have saved countless lives. The guinea pigs of Harvey W. Wiley, a chemist at the Department of Agriculture in America. And he is one of the reasons why the FDA, the Food and Drug Department, exists. He is like basically the reason why any kind of food health safety regulation exists in America.
And were these guinea pigs actual guinea pigs?
No, they were poor, very fit young men from the department.
Can we see a picture?
Poor, handsome men
in a doctor.
So this chemist basically tempted a group of physically very fit, healthy young men working in the department to eat free meals.
Anyone order a pizza?
Oh, boys.
Like really, really tasty food. The catch was half of them were going to be eating foods that were contaminated with preservatives that were used commonly throughout America and the rest of the world at the time. They all knew what was happening. I mean,
this was consensual then.
It was consensual, but it was really gnarly. So,
but they were like hot, dumb blondes. Like.
Yeah. But I think
they're patient. I'm stuck in the preservative jar.
But the point of this is that no one had really done any kind of systematic testing of the kinds of preservatives that were being used at the time. So when I say preservatives, I mean like borax, which is used as laundry detergent.
Very nice.
Jack.
Say if you get it in your eyes, you're recommended you rinse out. Like dangerous stuff. Formaldehyde.
Wow.
All of these just super poisonous chemicals. So yeah, basically some of their menus, this was their Christmas menu, included applesauce, borax, soup, borax, turkey, borax, string, but you get the idea.
I would love to see the Last Supper painting of that. Just these like 12 ripped scientists.
Eating Tide Pods. Yeah.
So because of his experiments and also a really famous book that was written by Upton Sinclair called The Jungle, in which he went and kind of did loads of research in the meatpacking industry and found out that there was like all sorts of horrendous hygiene practices, random meats, rats, like human body parts, feces, all of this stuff in the meat food chain, to the extent that like Europe refused to trade with the US for a bit. The Pure Food and Drug Act was passed in 1906.
Oh, cool.
According to Deborah Bloom, who's written a book on it called The Poison Squad, really, really fantastic.
They were called
book.
The Poison Squad. Wow. That's a movie I want to see.
That was Wiley's name for this experiment. Basically, the first time the US government takes responsibility for the health of its citizens, protecting people from, like, basically complete poison.
Pope Clement VII had done this 400 years earlier. Yeah.
And he used Uggos.
That's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes and questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
We have no recipe to recommend you this week, obviously.
Bad idea. Yeah.
If we survive, we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Manu Onryo, Alex Bell, and me, Jack Chambers. It was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.